Hello, this is Thomas Sullivan, the narrator of The Narrated Puritan. I love to look through books.google.com and find old books that have never been reprinted and yet are so very interesting for our time. And I came across this sketch of the life and ministry of Spurgeon. And ironically, if this came out in 1857, Spurgeon would have only have been 23 at the time. The author is George John Stevenson. So let's take a look at what he has to say, because it's a little premature for a life of Spurgeon, and yet it's still very interesting because it comes from a Methodist preacher. Introduction. Popular favor has seldom been shown to any man so extensively and so spontaneously as it has been to the Reverend Charles Haddon Spurgeon. Although some of the worst feelings of human nature have long been an active exercise to check the benevolent labors of this philanthropic youthful divine, yet an overseeing and an overruling providence has directed the issue. The favors of friends and the frowns of foes have together resulted in promoting the great work for which this modern Whitfield seems especially to be raised up, namely, to preach the gospel in a manner which shall secure its welcome to the hearts of multitudes who have hitherto disregarded it. Many have been the inquiries which have been made respecting Mr. Spurgeon's antecedents. One asks to which of the universities he belongs. Another wonders how so young a man obtained holy orders. A third puts the question plainly, who ordained the young man? A page would not suffice to enumerate the interrogatives we have ourselves heard from all classes of people, from the plain-spoken Englishmen, from the penetrating Scotchmen, from the mirthful son of Erin, and from not a few of our transatlantic brethren. Indeed, we have had this kind of verbal investigation continued with the greatest possible relish by the inquirer for an hour together without any apparent abatement in interest. In some instances, the desire for information has led to a succession of queries so varied and so strange that a prudent man would rather remain silent than try to satisfy such prurient curiosity. In this great London, thousands of voices have repeated the question in one day, who is this Spurgeon? And to many a negative was not an answer. So that where positive information of a reliable kind could not be obtained, imagination is too often supplied its place to the injury of both the subject of the sketch and the work in which he is engaged. So intense was the desire for information respecting Mr. Spurgeon during several months that whoever would risk a few pages of biographical anecdotes, historical incidents, or doctrinal peculiarities at the price of a penny was sure to sell the work by thousands. These transient phantoms have now all passed away, having satisfied the mere inquisitor. Whilst the seekers after knowledge are still eagerly desiring to know more, the number of these is still a multitude. Were it otherwise, we should not see such success as Sunday morning, from 10,000 to 12,000 persons, some from every part of London and its expansive suburbs, including many from the provinces, gathered to worship in the great Surrey Music Hall. Nor is the spirit of inquiry unnatural or wonderful. The wonder would be far greater were it otherwise. In the Church of England, such instances of youthful divines and youthful oratory are unknown. In the established church, the best-read student, the most fluent orator, the soundest divine, or the most earnest Christian in our universities must pass his 23rd year before he is allowed to exercise his gifts in publicly calling sinners to repentance. Our Southwark divine, on the contrary, but toward 23 summers have swept over his head, has not only been allowed to preach publicly and with authority, but with a power and a success which, considering the shortness of the period, really has no parallel. Long before an English churchman is considered of sufficient age and discretion to be presented to the bishop for ordination, our modern Whitfield has been a successful preacher for several years. So successful indeed that there are numerous towns and villages in the land in which his well-known voice is pilled out, it's come and welcome to congregations numbering not hundreds only, but repeatedly 10,000 persons. And from amongst whom some hundreds have been gathered out of the world and enfolded in the Church of Christ. We have met and conversed with English clergymen who are well aware of the secret of the success of this eminent preacher, and who righteously covet to some extent his gifts and his honors. There is a charm about the young man which wins the goodwill at the least of by far the greater majority of those who hear him. The existence of this charm is patent to the world, and its influence is already felt in every country where the Saxon character and the English language exist. There is one country where the good done by this laborious minister would not be recognized, but it is because Italian, not Saxon, blood flows in the veins of the inhabitants. Mr. Spurgeon's popularity is both wonderful and natural. There exist but few examples in either ancient or modern times of men so young producing an influence for good to his fellow men on so large a scale as in the instance before us. One of the youngest persons ever sent out into the work of the ministry amongst the Methodists was the late learned Dr. Adam Clark. Whilst yet a youth in his teens, we find him appointed to a circuit so wide that he had to preach in a different place once at the least during every day in each successive month. Although tall in person, yet so slender, he was generally denominated the little boy preacher. There are many points of resemblance in the early preaching career of this eminent scholar, divine and Christian, to those connected with Mr. Spurgeon. The almost tender years of both of these preachers prompted many to go and hear for themselves. In both cases, large multitudes of young persons of both sexes gathered together and formed a large proportion of the preacher's audience. In both cases, many persons of age and experience stood aloof for a time, throwing out innuendos, cautions, and warnings, and in both cases, such men lived long enough to acknowledge their error. Another preacher among the Wesleyans presents to us in some respects a parallel case to Mr. Spurgeon's, that of the Reverend Richard Watson. We read that impelled by a conviction of duty and an intense zeal for the spiritual good of mankind, the day after he was 15 years of age, Richard Watson preached his first sermon in a cottage a few miles from Lincoln. He continued to preach, prompted by the same excellent motives, with great success for nearly 40 years. There is, however, one point in the cases of these preachers which deserves notice more particularly, and many points the career of the two young Methodist preachers and the young Baptist minister very nearly agree. In age, learning, zeal, piety, and success, they are all three remarkable and are very near parallels. And the opposition to which they were all subject, and the persecution which was carried on against them with a very high hand, they are not dissimilar, excepting in this particular. The persecutors of the last century were the ordained clergy. Mr. Spurgeon's persecutors are not the clergy, though report represents some of them as jealous, others as envious, but persecution has come only from the press, or from that particular portion of it which would like to make religion a lifeless formality, and which shrinks alike from both conscience and eternity. The clergy of our day not only do not persecute the Southwark evangelist, they rather seek and embrace every occasion which offers to go and hear for themselves. And where they cannot go and hear, we know that very many of them read Mr. Spurgeon's published discourses with great satisfaction and pleasure. Here then we think we have an instance of true greatness, a young divine whose powerful voice, whose untiring zeal, whose ardent love of his work prompt him to labors more abundant, and trying to do good alike to the bodies and the souls of the greatest number of his fellow creatures. In the late Reverend William J., we have another example of a very young man giving himself to the service of the ministry. In an old, almost forgotten book called The Triumph of Faith, we find a reference to the employment of young J. at about the age of 16 in publicly proclaiming the truths of the gospel to perishing sinners. His career of usefulness on a large scale continued for more than half a century. Nor is our good friend of New Park Street alone in our own times as a very young man raised up by Almighty God to rouse the slumbering churches of England. pastors of churches, ye who have had flocks without increase for many years past, God calls you by the example of these young men to try the power of faith, living, acting, faith. Try it. God has owned and prospered the zealous labors of these young men, and he will continue to own them. Imitate their example. Let your motto be onwards. Faith is a very powerful energy. Use it, test it, exhaust it if you can. Faith removes mountains and laughs at impossibilities. Great revivals of religion have generally emanated from the zeal, painstaking, and self-denial of young persons. The two Wesleys were young when 160 years ago they commenced their great work. Whitfield was young when his extraordinary labors and eloquence were the means of gathering multitudes out of the world and enfolding them in the Church of Christ. William J. Adam Clark, and many others might be named in proof of this point, as such results should be looked for more than they have been, as evidence of dutiful obedience to that God, who having forgiven much, deserves diligent and earnest service in return. The next chapter is called, Who is this Spurgeon? To this inquiry, many have in vain sought for an answer. The following pages will furnish what we think will be received as demonstrative evidence that Mr. Spurgeon has been raised up and specially trained by divine providence to accomplish a great moral and spiritual work in this land by promoting the well-being of both the bodies and the souls of the multitudes who almost daily throng to hear him. The villages of England, more than the cities, have the honor of producing our great men. The city may be favorable to early development and sometimes to precocity and talent, but it too often wanes ere it has reached maturity. In the village, the faculties develop themselves as nature forms them. In a city, a thousand elusive influences are constantly working on the minds of the young. And for one who adopts a course which is at once upright and successful, a thousand go wrong. The whole population of Kelvedon in Essex, in which Mr. Spurgeon was born, does not number 2,000 souls, whilst his Sabbath morning congregations often number 10,000 persons, so that almost weekly he preaches to five times more persons than were contained in the place which gave him birth. Kelvedon has had advantages in religion which have influenced the population. For more than 50 years has the same clergyman preached in the parish church, and his life has been in accordance with his preaching. The Reverend Charles Dalton lately celebrated his jubilee as the incumbent of that village, and his long life of consistent piety has not been without its all-pervading influence on the villagers. Mrs. Spurgeon is of nonconformist descent, and entered this world on the 19th of June, 1834. His venerable grandfather, the Reverend James Spurgeon, still lives and continues his ministerial duties as pastor of an independent church at Stambourne, near Halstead in Essex. The father of our Southwark divine is Mr. John Spurgeon, second son of the aforenamed Reverend James Spurgeon, now of Colchester, who, although occupied as a layman during the week, is a pastor of a small independent church at Tollesbury in Essex. The mother of Mr. Spurgeon was the youngest sister of Charles Parker Jarvis of Colchester, a woman remarkable for piety, usefulness, and humility. Here, then, we have presumptive, as we can safely add, positive evidence of the example of both personal and family religion. For at least two generations operating in the formation of the mind of our youthful divine. Praying parents, oh the charm, the power of such influences. Parents, you who fear God, let your light so shine before your children, that they may follow after godliness and imitating you. The father of George Whitfield was the son of a clergyman, but George was born at a well-known inn kept by Thomas Whitfield in Gloucester. It is somewhat remarkable that whilst George Whitfield is known as the potboy of his father's inn, the birthplace of Mr. Spurgeon, called the modern Whitfield, in Kelvedon, has since the removal of Mr. John Spurgeon to Colchester been used as a wayside inn also. Here are both extremes and parallels. In both cases, religion is a family possession and the power of prayer is expansive. Careful home training, pervaded by the influence of personal and family religion, is capable of and has resulted in an immeasurable amount of good. At a very early period, the infant's virgin, who was the first grandchild in the family, was removed from his father's residence at Kelvedon to his grandfather's at Stambourne and placed under the care of Hans Virgin, his father's sister. It is needless to add with what delight the venerable pair welcomed the stranger in the family. Miss Anne's Virgin was at that time not in a good state of health, and both the grandparents of the infant believed that the care of the child would have a beneficial effect on the health of their daughter. Theirs all proved the wisdom of their decision. Under the fostering care of the aunt and the solicitude of the grandparents, the health of the former gradually improving, the child grew in strength and soon became the admired and beloved of all who knew him. Affection blended with personal piety was the watchword of the household. Aunt Anne loved and cherished most tenderly her infant charge, and she received as her reward the sincere affection of her adopted child. The affection between the two became as strong as between a child and its parent, and Mother Anne and stepson Charles are terms as familiar and endearing in this case as are the terms mother and child in ordinary cases. The first dawnings of reason were observed, and care was taken to inform and instruct by such degrees as the opening faculties could receive. From infancy, the mind of the child seems to have been formed after nature's model. When but an infant, he would divert himself for hours together with a book of pictures, although unable either to speak, plain, or read. His love of books dates from the first openings of his mind. One of the books which served to amuse the many hours of early childhood contained, amongst other illustrations, a portrait of Bonner, the Bishop of London. He was informed that Bishop Bonner was a persecutor of some of the servants of God, and although so young, an effect was produced on his mind which will never be erased. And a child manifested such a dislike to the name that he always called that picture as a term of derision, and in righteous indignation, Old Bonner. This is powerful censure from a boy so young. To this period of his life may be traced the origin of that intense abhorrence of American slavery and of tyranny in every form and under every name to which Mr. Spurgeon sometimes gives utterance. Another feature characteristic of Mr. Spurgeon is traceable to this early period. Even in infancy, he manifested a marked attachment to those who were said or even supposed to be the children of God. He had a special preference to the house of God. To him it was not merely a pleasure to go and a source of joy to remain, but it was a positive delight. When he had acquired the art of reading, his joy in being able to unite in the worship of God in the sanctuary scarcely knew any bounds. This feeling does not abate, for we find by the public papers that he is preaching in some part of England almost every day, and in some cases in two different towns in one day. Unlike most children, play had not the charm for the youthful Spurgeon which a book had, and when he had learned to gather the sense of a book, his desire for the acquirement of knowledge amounted to a passion, so that considerable restraint had to be exercised to prevent injury to the mind of the young scholar. In this respect, there is a remarkable parallel between Spurgeon and the late Duke of Wellington. Of the latter we are informed that whilst his schoolfellows enjoyed their games, he often stood aloof, his mind apparently occupied with something less volatile than play. As a child is so generally, will the man be. Before the child was 6 years old, he could read well, with a tone and emphasis beyond his age. Give him his book and his liberty, and when he was wanted, he was always found in seclusion with his book, enjoying that which was, to most children, only a drudgery. Here it was that he laid the foundation of that varied and extended acquaintance with the writings of good old John Bunyan, Richard Baxter, and others of that period. There is a charm about the works of the Tinker of Bedford which has captivated millions of people, young and old. Dr. Johnson has written that there are three books which every man can take up with the same relish for the second as for the first reading. These are the Bible, Pilgrim's Progress, and Robinson Crusoe. No wonder then that our young friend was captivated with these works and read them with eager delight. Christian fellowship is one of the great privileges of all the children of God. During the early years of Spurgeon's life, spent in the family of his grandfather, there were many occasions on which various members of the church met at the residence of their pastor, and there taken sweet counsel together, enjoyed the communion of saints. On many of these saints' meetings, which are remembered with delight by the friends at Stambourne, the grandchild of the pastor astonished many by his questions and conversation. Often he would propose a subject and offer remarks upon it which astonished much older and experienced persons. From infancy he was remarkable for decision of character, and his decision was taken for God. There was no halting between two opinions. He boldly and steadfastly maintained his choice. When under 6 years of age, he saw in the village a man who professed religion, mixed up with a number of others known to be ungodly men. He felt a desire to reprove the professor, and in the name and in the strength of the God he served, he boldly went up to the man and addressed him in these words, "Elijah, what doest thou here?" The man was dumb under the reproof, and the boy came away with the conviction that he had done his duty. God always rewards those who serve him faithfully. Self-possession is a feature strongly marked in Spurgeon. His cool and collected behavior during the unfortunate Surrey Gardens catastrophe was the astonishment of many. Shortly before that event, whilst preaching to a large audience in Isleton, he made a sudden pause in the service and remarked, with great firmness of manner, "There are two persons near the door. If they do not behave better, I must desire the police to remove them," and went on with the service as though there had been no interruption. And again, with an audience of some 10,000 persons before him, only a few weeks ago in the Surrey Hall, after expounding the first of two lessons, he announced the chapter of the second lesson and then said, "If I make a short pause between the lessons, it will give an opportunity for those persons who have their hats on to take them off in the house of God." He preached that morning from the text, "Wist ye not that I must be about my Father's business?" And one more suitable to describe the persevering and untiring labors of this devoted servant of God could not well have been chosen. "Young men, young ministers, let the same mind be in you. Decision for God and boldness in the service will bring you to a present reward, great or small, in proportion to your zeal." When about 7 years old, Spurgeon returned to his father's home. During his residence at Stambourne, his parents had removed from Kelvedon to Colchester, in which town Mr. John Spurgeon was occupied. He was at once placed in a respectable school conducted by Mr. Henry Lewis. The head usher in the school was Mr. Leading, who afterwards removed from Colchester to Cambridge, and there opened a school for young gentlemen. 4 years were spent in the school at Colchester, and here the ready mind of the pupil soon attracted the special attention of Mr. Leading. To this gentleman, our young friend is indebted for nearly all the knowledge he acquired, which could be there communicated. In every branch of knowledge to which he devoted his attention, C.H. Spurgeon was sure to become a master of it. And invariably, at the examinations, our young friend was a successful prize man. When about 10 years of age, he was spending a vacation with his grandsire at Stambourne. The anniversary sermons for the Missionary Society were preached in his grandfather's chapel whilst he was there. The preacher was the late Reverend Richard Neal. This earnest and devoted servant of God has left behind him a memory for good which will be cherished with much affection for many years. Inscribed on the portrait of the self-denying missionary is a motto which indicated the intensity of his love for his work. It is, "Brethren, the heathen are perishing. Shall we let them perish? God forbid." Knowing this of the preacher, it is not wonderful that he discerned in the grandson of the venerable Spurgeon the germs of his future distinction. Mr. Neal remained with the village pastor on the night of the anniversary. The following particulars we give from a communication kindly supplied by the Reverend James Spurgeon of Stambourne. "Before family prayer," observes the delighted grandfather, "my grandson read a chapter out of the scriptures, and our friend Neil was very much pleased and said, 'I've heard old ministers and young ones read well, but never did I hear a little boy read so correctly before.' He called him to his side, laid his venerable hand on his head, and said, 'I believe God will raise him up for some remarkable work. I hope he will one day fill Roland Hill's pulpit. It appears to me, continues the grandfather, as if he spake under a spirit of prophecy. When Mr. Neal first heard of my grandson being in town, he wrote to me for his address. The reason he gave was, being then from home, with a large party of friends. After dinner, the conversation turned upon a wonderful preacher who was pastor of the new Park Street Chapel. Mr. Neal inquired his name, and the answer was given, Mr. Spurgeon. I know him, said Mr. Neal. No, no, replied his friend, I think not. Oh, yes, I do, sir, returned Mr. Neal. I saw him at his grandfather's house some years ago when I preached in a village for the missionary cause, and have always been convinced that he would one day be a most extraordinary character in the Christian world. I remember, continued Mr. Neal, taking the lad into the garden. I conversed with him and prayed with him and found that he possessed a mind far beyond his years. Mr. Neal died at Chester 3 months ago and was buried in a cemetery there. The greater part of the citizens showed their respect to his memory by attending his funeral, whilst amongst the mourners near the grave was the present bishop of Chester, Dr. Drain. Here, then, we have a very striking testimony to prove that very early in life, Mr. Spurgeon manifested those evidences of future usefulness and distinction which have been so amply and so remarkably realized. There is a power and influence in home training which is capable of immense good or evil, according to the manner and direction given to the mind of a youth. As a rule, praying parents, if they make prayer a cheerful duty with their offspring, may have praying children. Mr. Spurgeon had the advantage of praying parents and grandparents. Chiefly to his beloved mother is he indebted for the bias of his mind towards the Word of God and the people of God. On every suitable occasion, his mother retired with him and others of her children into the quietude of the closet, where by reading the Scriptures and applying them to the spiritual wants of her child, in a way many pious mothers have before done, and then praying with or for him, the love of these Christians' duties grew with growth and prayer, and a study of the Bible soon became his delight. Such exercises always strengthen affection between the members of the family, and similar results were experienced in this case. Between the child and his parents on the one hand, and between the parents and the child on the other hand, as well as amongst the children themselves, there always existed the warmest possible attachment and affection. Happy children in praying families often sing, when brethren all in one agree, who knows the joys of unity. There still exists amongst all the members of the family the strongest feeling of personal concern and affectionate regard. Such maternal solicitude resulted in giving a decided choice to religion to the mind of her son Charles. So there is scarcely a period in his existence in which his mind has not been under the hallowing influences of personal practical religion. Seek ye first the kingdom of heaven, and God has declared himself engaged on the side of such seekers to promote their welfare every way. When but a youth, scarcely in his teens, we learn from communications kindly furnished by Mr. Spurgeon's father that the youth was often found in the hayrack, or the manger, reading aloud, talking, or sometimes preaching to his brothers and sisters, so anxious was he to be doing good. Such exercises encouraged a feeling which was early manifested in favor of the ministry as the occupation of his life. And when he was residing at Cambridge in 1850, the entrance of one of his early companions on a collegiate course led his own mind in that direction for a time. In a letter written home to his mother at that time, he declines the distinction of joining his friend at college and adds, "If the Lord will teach me to know his statutes and prepare me to preach his gospel to his poor people, I have my desire." How happy is that man who spends his whole life in serving God and can go the heathen bearing the word of life. He is the noblest of all men. In the matters of religion, he was always before his age and a teacher of his companions, whilst his brothers and other associates were engaged with amusements and trifles and mimic imitations of workmen, Charles Spurgeon eschewed all such pursuits, and taking his Bible or other good book, would seclude himself, and with intense delight would study and read away the hours other children gave to play. He was never exercised himself in any kind of handicraft, the bent of his mind being entirely in another direction. He was a boy of strong passions and always possessed a determined will. This gave great concern at one time to his parents, and most earnestly did they both pray that the great head of the church would give the lad grace to keep that will under and subject to the will of God. Both his parents had a firm conviction, which was confirmed by others who knew him, that he would one day occupy a distinguished place in the world, and hence arose their natural anxiety that their son should excel in the service of God. Besides his strong passions and determined will, there were other points which had their influence in the formation of his character. From the earliest dawn of reason, owing to the care taken in his religious instruction, he appears to have had very clear views of the great leading doctrines of the New Testament, of the condition of man as a sinner, and of the nature of the sacrifice and death of Christ. He was able to give a simple explanation as a child. Supported by a memory of great vigor and power, anything once learned was his own and was never lost. Hence his preaching at the present time derives much of its efficacy and attractiveness from his great power of memory, furnishing always at the right time the right kind of illustration to make an argument clear to his audience, or to adapt things of the past to his present emergencies. Such a power of memory and such an uninterrupted flow of language suitable to every subject on which he may preach seldom falls to the inheritance of ordinary men. Another important help in forming character aright, Mr. Spurgeon has found in his simple habits of living, which have resulted in securing and fostering a healthy condition of both mind and body. He may on this account be considered capable of enduring an amount of labor and fatigue which would destroy a frame more habituated to indulgences. He knew not what illness was till the Surrey Gardens calamity, joined with the wicked calumnies of a portion of the press, laid prostrate even the strong man. He had the advantage of an education in the best school that could be found, and if that education was not completed in a college, the fault was entirely his own. Often and earnestly was this point urged upon him by his parents, and on one of his father's visits to him whilst at Cambridge, he spent some hours in the attempt to convince his son of the advantages which such a course of study would secure to him. But in vain, as we have said on a previous page, he had a conviction on his own mind that his duty lay not in a college but in the church and in the pulpit. And very many young divines have wasted years of precious time and energy in the cloisters of learning, which might have been better employed in the more active exercises of ministerial life. He did not, however, come to the conclusion against a course of instruction in a college without much prayerful deliberation, and the advice of those in whose welfare his heart's affections were bound up. He was already the pastor over a flourishing church when the subject came before him for consideration, and in a letter to his subject from Cambridge in the spring of 1852, he writes, "I'm not asking that I may go at all to college, but only that I may not go just now. The tears of the people, I hope, will prevail." And as he hoped, so God's providence decided. Himself submissive to do that which his best friends in the church might, in answer to much earnest prayer, recommend. It is not the wisdom of man, nor the powerful influence of learning, but the foolishness of preaching, which the Almighty owns in reaching and impressing the hearts of sinners. Having received the instruction in Colchester, which the best school could supply, when about 15 years old, it was deemed expedient that he should have some knowledge of a few branches of learning, which were specially taught in an agricultural college at Maidstone, then conducted by one of his relatives. There, however, he was left much to his own inclination, and he very eagerly devoted his leisure time to the diligent pursuit of such studies as were most congenial to his own mind. Maidstone, as well as at the school of Colchester, he was a successful prizeman at the examination. Indeed, he never failed in gaining a prize at school on any occasion when they were given for success and study. After remaining 1 year at Maidstone, he removed in his 16th year, 1849, to Newmarket, where he was engaged in the school of Mr. Swindle as usher. Mr. Swindle was a Baptist. At Newmarket, he pursued the study of the Greek and French languages with great care and diligence. Whilst he was eminently diligent in business, he was equally fervent in spirit, serving the Lord. His duties and trials in the school were such as would have broken down any but the most patient person. During the years spent at that place, many important changes had their origin or their full development, which have greatly contributed to the remarkable success of our Southwark Divine. There he learned to practice much self-denial. There also he began to see himself to be a lost and unworthy sinner, deserving the full punishment of God's anger upon his sins. There was it he started on that mad voyage which he has thus pathetically referred to in one of his sermons. Speaking of a free thinker, he remarks, "I too have been like him. There was an evil hour in which I slipped the anchor of my faith. I cut the cable of my belief. I no longer moored myself hard by the coasts of revelation. I allowed my vessel to drift before the wind. I said to reason, 'Be thou my captain.' I said to my own brain, 'Be thou my rudder.' And I started on my mad voyage. Thank God it is all over now. But I will tell you its brief history. It was one hurried sailing over the tempestuous ocean of free thought. The result was that from doubting some things, he came to question everything, even his own existence. Thus the devil foiled himself. Faith came to the rescue of bewildered reason, and from that perilous voyage brought back the wanderer safe to land. She who had nursed him in infancy, like the grandmother of Timothy, is pictured as exclaiming before the throne of God in heaven, 'I thank thee, O thou ever gracious one, that he who was my child on earth is now become thy child in light.' There too, having conquered those violent extremes to which Satan often drives a sinner who is repenting of his sins, and having fled for refuge and found a welcome and safety in the bosom of a crucified Jesus, his sins forgiven and his spirit enjoying the liberty of the adopted children of God, his joy knew no bounds, although his life had been from infancy more or less devoted to the service of God. Still he had not realized that change of heart which is implied by the new birth." Under a powerful and impressive sermon preached from Isaiah 45:22, "Look unto me and be saved, all the ends of the earth," the Spirit of God so wrought upon his heart that after suffering much agony of mind, he found in believing that faith which passes understanding. His spirit was now overflowing with happiness. All the letters he sent home at that period were full of the overflowings of a grateful heart. And although not 16 years old, he describes the operations of grace on the heart and life, and the differences between the doctrines of the gospel and the forms of the church, in terms so precise and clear that no merely human power could have enabled him to do. Being justified by faith, he had peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ. He was taught experimentally by the Holy Spirit, and he spake as the Spirit gave him utterance. He had hitherto been brought up amongst the independents. There and at that period it was that his views changed respecting a point in church discipline. He had experienced a change of heart. He felt it to be laid upon him as an imperative duty to make a full and public confession of the change by public baptism. He wrote many letters of inquiry, soliciting advice and information from his father. On both sides, there was much frank and open candor. No arguments Mr. John Spurgeon, the independent minister, could use were considered by his son as sufficient to alter his purpose of making a public confession of his faith in the manner named. At length, the father consents. The son satisfies his father clearly that he has no faith in baptismal regeneration, and the necessary steps are taken for his admission as a member into the Baptist Church. In his last letter to his father on the subject, dated Newmarket, May 1, Spurgeon wrote, "If I know my own heart, I believe that the sentiment uppermost there is that salvation is not of man, that no works, however holy, can contribute in the least to save my soul, that the work is all of God's sovereign electing love, and that if ever I am saved, it will be by his power alone." The necessary arrangements having been made, he walked from Newmarket to Isleham, 7 miles on May 2nd, and staying with the family of the Baptist minister there, Mr. Cantlow. He was publicly baptized in that village by the minister just named on Friday, May 3rd, 1850, being in his 16th year. He thus proceeds in a letter to his father before quoted from, "It is very pleasing to me that the day on which I shall openly profess the name of Jesus is my mother's birthday. May it be to both of us a foretaste of many glorious and happy days yet to come. Who that have the heart to feel would not heartily respond to such a prayer by such a son? Amen." Having thus publicly devoted himself to the service of God, he was more earnest than ever in his efforts to do good. Besides having himself revived an old society for distributing tracts, he undertook to carry out this good work in the town thoroughly. Whenever he walked out, he carried these messengers of mercy with him and was instant in season, and indeed was seldom out of season in his efforts to do good. His duties in school occupied him 3 hours daily, the remainder of his time being spent in his closet or in some work of mercy. The Sunday school very soon gained his attention, and his addresses to the children were so full of love and instruction that the children carried the good tidings home to their parents, and soon they came to hear the addresses in the vestry of the independent chapel in that town. The place was soon filled. On Saturday he had more leisure, and on that day he commenced a new tract district in what is called the New Town. During all that year he was subject to personal trials, hardships, and inconveniences, which greatly exercised his faith and would have overwhelmed many, but he did not yield. At one of the examinations of the school, it was his duty to deliver an oration on missions. It was a public occasion, and in the company was a clergyman. During the examination, the clergyman heard of the death of his gardener and suddenly left for home. But on his way, thus reasoned with himself, "The gardener is dead. I cannot restore his life. I will return and hear what the young usher has to say on missions." He returned and heard the oration and was pleased to show his approval by presenting Mr. Spurgeon with a sovereign. Whilst he was resident at Newmarket, Mr. Morley of Nottingham offered a prize for the best essay on popery. Only 3 essays were sent in, one of which was written by Mr. Spurgeon. The Reverend George Smith of Poplar was the adjudicator, who after a delay of 2 years wrote a kind and encouraging letter to Mr. Spurgeon, stating that though his paper was not deemed entitled to the premium, yet the gentleman who offered it, and who was a relative, in approval of his zeal, and in the hope that he might employ his talents for the public good, sent him a handsome sum of money as a gratuity. This essay is entitled Antichrist and Her Brood, or Popery Unmasked, and is thus endorsed, written by a boy under 16 years of age. This early production of Mr. Spurgeon's pen has not yet been published. After a residence of 1 year, he removed to Cambridge and became an usher under Mr. Henry Leading, who had shortly before opened a school for young gentlemen in that university, Borough. Gratitude to Mr. Leading for the instruction received from him at Colchester led Mr. Spurgeon to that establishment. There his duties were less arduous and his comforts greatly increased. He maintained his faith in God unmoved, though often it was tested. The experiences of most Christian churches goes far to prove that, with many young persons who become members, they find it expedient thus to identify themselves with the community of the people of God. With Mr. Spurgeon, religion was a matter of the heart. It was a principle. Go where he might, because his heart had been touched with a live coal from off the altar of heaven, he carried his religion with him. It was to be seen in his conduct because it was a matter of experience within him. It was not merely a business which could be but put on or laid aside like a garment, but was a result of a deliberate and prayerful choice, proceeding from a course of careful training in wisdom's ways. It was an emanation from the divine mind. with the will of the human nature yielding and consenting. God called, man obeyed. Truly happy are all they who thus yield to the strivings of the Holy Spirit. A decided love of whatsoever things are of good report had been manifested in his life even from infancy. When a child of very tender years, he strongly evinced his love of and preference to good people, and there are many aged Christians in the county of Essex who remembered him as a child with a countenance beaming with joy and delight at having an opportunity of conversing with him on matters of personal religion. Of this number, there are not a few faithful men of God whose daily privilege it is to pray for their young friend, that his life may be spared and that his labors may be abundantly owned by a large ingathering of stray sheep into the fold of Christ. Out of many instances which might be recorded in confirmation of this point of character, the following is given, just as it is furnished by Mr. Spurgeon's grandfather. When my grandson was very young, he went one day into a field where a very pious man was plowing. He was a member of my church. The child began to ask some questions on religious subjects which the good man thought far beyond his age. The conversation continued some time on spiritual subjects until the man was quite amazed at what he had heard, although he was a man deeply experienced in the things of God. At last the man said to my grandson, "My dear boy, God has given you great gifts, great grace, and great experience. My prayer to God for you is that he may keep you truly humble. For if you rise one inch above the ground, you must be cut down." I cannot add, Sir Reverend James Spurgeon, but hope that this prayer has been answered. I am amazed and thankful to God that my grandson is kept humble. From such testimony we learn this truly gratifying lesson, that God can perfect praise out of the mouths of babes, and that our young Timothy has known the Scriptures from a child. Unlike too many young professors, Mr. Spurgeon carried his religion about with him, and on removing to a large town where many dangers were likely to beset his path, he at once identified himself with the people of God. How many there are who have to trace their declension in religion to a want of courage to avow themselves members of a Christian church when they remove to a place where they are unknown. In London there is a great multitude who thus suffer themselves to be robbed of the greatest blessings which we can know on earth, even the communion of saints. In London, every denomination of Christians is so well represented that no excuse can exist for young Christians, fresh from the country, not joining that form of religion in which they've been brought up. Like a true servant of the Most High, our young friend could not be unfaithful to the vows he had taken upon himself. He had been useful in the Sunday school in giving practical and animating addresses to both children and their parents. He had been useful in visiting the poor at their dwellings and carrying with him a little tract to instruct the ignorant. In being called of God to this work, he did it with his might. He removed from Newmarket to Cambridge in the year 1850, after staying 1 year only at the former place. Having at once identified himself as a member of the Baptist Church in Cambridge, he soon found occupation suitable to his mind. His addresses to children, and afterwards to parents and children, had produced a love of the work, and he soon was called to exhort a village congregation. He was then about 16 years old. His duties in Mr. Leading's school being lighter than in his former place, he had leisure to occupy himself in trying to do good. Connected with the Baptist Church meeting in St. Andrew Street, Cambridge, formerly under the pastoral care of the late learned Robert Hall, there existed a society entitled the Lay Preachers Association. Although so young in years, Mr. Spurgeon was accepted as a member of this association. He had once found the occupation which his mind most desired, and he was soon appointed to address a congregation. Although we have not been able to learn what was the text selected by the youthful divine on this interesting occasion, nor have we heard any report of the service, yet we know one result which has proceeded from it. Good was done, and the preacher was encouraged. Mr. Spurgeon's first sermon was preached in a cottage in the village of Teversham, about 4 miles from Cambridge. The Lay Preachers Association was instituted to enable the poor inhabitants of the villages surrounding Cambridge to hear the gospel in their own homes, where dress would be no barrier to their assembling together, and at the same time to provide them with preachers who should address them in terms which they might readily understand. There were 13 village stations mapped out, some of which were many miles from the town, and in one or more of these stations, service was held every evening in the week. Having once entered into this most solemn duty and finding acceptance with the people, he laid himself out for one service every evening after attending to his duties in school during the day. It would be unfair to criticize those early efforts at public teaching by the ordinary rules which we apply to public preaching. The tender years of the speaker, and being besides self-taught in divinity, and in most of the branches of human learning, these should induce a spirit of forbearance. The desire and the ability to preach God had implanted within him. Experience could only be learned by the exercise of the gifts which had been bestowed. The New Testament teaches that both the operations of nature and of grace are progressive, that we have first a blade in the ear, then a full corn in the ear. These early preaching efforts were acceptable to the people, and they were owned and blessed by God. From an aged and experienced Christian who heard Mr. Spurgeon preach before his call to London, we learn that his addresses were very instructive and often included illustrations derived from history, geography, astronomy, and from other branches of school occupation, evidently adapted from his daily duties, and thus made to serve as instruments in religion as well as in training and informing the mind. Since Mr. Spurgeon has been the popular preacher of the day, we have often heard mammon-getting men of the world ascribe his popularity to motives so mercenary that we will not betray the ignorance of our fellow citizens by repeating them. They have gone beyond the point of impugning the preacher's motives and have censored his deacons as participators in the results we have referred to, and prompters to a course of action as basis can well be attributed to fallen human nature. All such notions are as groundless as they are uncharitable and as unreasonable as they are untrue. For several years, Mr. Spurgeon had no gain whatever from his benevolent labors but hopes of many kinds. Even at the present time, though he is the almoner of the bounty of many and a generous bestower of his goods to feed the poor, yet he has neither the riches nor the influence which are often ascribed to him. Few public men are paid worse than public preachers for benevolent objects. The early ministry of Spurgeon was not only gratuitous, but often attended with demands on a small salary, which he willingly gave to God, not to be seen of men, but to help the needy. The poor man's preacher in all ages of the church has always been poor, and though the bounty of others may make him the dispenser of their wealth, yet he cannot himself preach the everlasting gospel and amass riches for his reward. From the commencement of Spurgeon's ministry, it may be truly said that the common people heard him gladly. From the first, the result has been the same in two respects. His hearers have been uniformly numerous, and his preaching is uniformly acceptable. The motives which impelled his choice justify the result. This had been the earnest desire and prayer of his parents for many years. Anxiously did they pray that their son Charles might be a servant of Christ and a preacher of righteousness.